Speak No Evil, a novel, written by Alison Brennan, narrated by Tim Lundeen. Prologue. At the very beginning, she had seen his face and knew he would not let her live. She couldn't plead with him. He'd sealed her mouth shut. No way to beg, to appeal to his humanity. He had no humanity. Why hadn't she seen it before? Had she been so blind that when he looked at her, she couldn't see the hatred, the anger, the sick lust? She trusted him because she had no reason not to. But looking at him now, she saw the evil he'd hidden so well for so long. The pain that had kept her awake for two nights had dulled, her body numb from abuse. She didn't think about it. Didn't think about him, turned into herself, and remembered swimming at the beach, or talking to her friends, or how her mom was so proud of her when she graduated high school, with honors. Burning tears leaked from her eyes.
I'm so sorry, Mom.
He untied her once, to give her a bath. She was too weak to run, too tired to fight. But fierce pain reawakened when he scrubbed her body with soap, making her scream, a deep rumbling in her chest that couldn't escape through her glued lips.
I need to wash your body, he told her calmly. Just in case.
Just in case of what? The water hurt, but it also woke her up. Maybe she had a chance. Maybe she could escape. If she could just scream, someone would come, wouldn't they? She didn't even know where she was. He carried her back to the bed that reeked of her blood, her urine, and worse. She tried to get up, to run, but her legs gave way and she slipped to the floor. He gave an odd, coarse laugh at her weak attempt to escape before picking her up as if she weighed nothing and dropping her on the bed. Then, she saw the garbage bag.
No!
She heard herself, but no one else could, as the bag came over her head. She fought him with everything she had, and the bag tore. Slap! The pain across her face was nothing compared to what she had already endured, but her strength didn't match his. Another dark green plastic bag slid down over her face. She tried to hold her breath, but couldn't. Something else was pulled over her legs. She began to fade. She almost didn't feel him tie up her body. She was light. A feather. Death was her escape. There had to be something better than this. Something brighter. Something happy. A heavy weight covered her body. Him. He was on top of her, and she couldn't breathe. Plastic molded to her nose and her chest tightened.
No air.
She couldn't fight, but her body tried. Her legs weakly kicked, her fingers clawed at the slick lining.
So tired. Can't.
In the brief moment between life and death, when her body fought but her mind knew there was no hope, an odd peace washed over her.
I'm sorry, Mom.
Chapter 1. Her death had not been easy. Homicide Detective Corinna Kincaid stared at the dead, naked corpse of the young woman, avoiding the wide-eyed terror etched on her face. Her mouth was gagged, but what drew Corinna's eye was the word slut scrawled in thick black marker across her chest. A small red rose was tattooed on her left breast. The victim lay in a disjointed fetal position, dried blood on her legs and vicious red welts on her breasts, indicating that her murder had followed a sexual assault. In California, that made the killer eligible for the death penalty. One small step toward justice, but it didn't satisfy Corinna. This Jane Doe would still be dead. She glanced away from the body, just for a moment, and watched the waves roll up the beach, back and forth, calming. Her cheeks stung from the early morning salt air, but in just a few hours she'd be tugging off her windbreaker as the sun peaked over San Diego.
When she first arrived on the scene with Jim Gage, supervisor of the Forensic Field Services Unit of the San Diego Police Department, they immediately documented that the evidence had been contaminated. Three layers of heavy-duty green garbage bags had been cut away from the body. The park ranger hadn't been able to lift what he thought was trash, so he sliced it open. What had he been thinking?
"I didn't think there was a body inside,"
he'd said when Corinna questioned him. By the tension in Jim's jaw, it was obvious that he was pissed. But, true to form, he didn't say anything. He never said anything, which had been the primary reason Corinna had broken up with him last year. She could handle his moodiness. She had four brothers. She could put up with almost anything. But his refusal to talk about what bugged him, on the job and off, was a relationship breaker. Or maybe they hadn't loved each other enough to make it work. Corinna glanced behind them when she heard a car approach. The coroner's van pulled into the empty parking lot, and a short, trim, well-dressed Asian man exited the vehicle. Assistant Coroner Ted Chen, the perfectionist. Corinna liked it when he pulled one of her cases, even if he made her a bit self-conscious. She triple-checked her reports when he was the responding coroner, afraid to appear the novice, despite her nearly 11 years on the job.
"Dr. Chen is here," she told Jim.
"Hmm."
Jim finished photographing the body and surrounding area, glancing up as Dr. Chen crossed the sand to where the body lay.
"Hello, Ted."
"Gage? Detective?"
Chen nodded toward the victim.
"Was the body found in this condition?" "The bag had been intact. The park ranger opened it."
"Why on earth would he do that?" Jim removed his wire-rim glasses and rubbed his eyes with his forearm.
"Thought it was filled with garbage, and planned on taking multiple trips to dispose of the contents."
Chen shook his head in disgust, his thin lips a tight line. He knelt in the sand, careful to prevent further granules from rolling into the plastic.
"She suffocated," he said quietly.
"You mean she was put into the bag alive?"
Corinna asked for clarification.
"It would appear so, but the crime lab will need to go over the bag to confirm it," Chen said.
"See her discoloration? The victim appeared bluish, almost purple.
No oxygen, no sign of strangulation, and no blood in her eyes or ears to indicate it either. I can give you a better answer at the autopsy." He glanced at his watch. "I have three autopsies scheduled this morning, but I'll postpone the afternoon schedule to fit her in."
"Thanks, Dr. Chen. I appreciate it."
"I'll have her on the table at 2.
Corinna nodded, caught Jim staring at her, his face unreadable.
"You going to join us?" she asked.
"We'll see how far my team can get with the bag. We're backlogged as it is."
No surprise. Contrary to popular television, most evidence wasn't processed until a suspect was apprehended and a court date set. The wheels of justice also turned the cogs of the laboratory. Corinna forced herself to stare at the victim's face, while Chen and Jim prepared for her transportation to the morgue. She looked so young. 18, maybe. Was she a college student? There were two universities within spitting distance of the beach. Maybe she was still in high school. She thought about her baby sister. Well, Lucy wasn't a baby anymore. She was a high school senior, and smart enough to go to just about any college she wanted. Their parents wanted her to stay close to home. Lucy desperately wanted to move away. But college campuses were dangerous, and Corinna found herself siding with her parents on this one. 14 years ago, she wanted the exact same thing as Lucy, to get out from under her parents' thumb. But that was before she'd decided to become a cop. Before she realized how truly dangerous the city could be. Before she realized that justice wasn't always swift, and that the system didn't always work, that some murders would never be solved. She turned away from the death scene and stared again at the Pacific Ocean, unconsciously wrapping her arms around her waist. It would be temperate today, as virtually every day was in San Diego. Here on the coast, the cool morning breeze loosed a few strands of dark hair from the French braid Corinna wore when on the job. The tide was receding. The waves, small and playful, pulling back. The shells and rocks reflected the sunrise behind her, the ocean still dark and mysterious. A pair of early morning joggers, a man and woman, ran on the packed sand. Had the girl been murdered here, on this quiet, clean beach? Or had Jane Doe been dumped? Corinna voted for dumped, but asked the experts.
Dumped is my guess, Jim said. There's no sign of struggle. But of course the scene's been contaminated.
He visually scanned the area to confirm his hypothesis. Corinna followed his gaze to the parking lot adjacent to this stretch of beach. The highway on the other side was beginning to bustle with morning commuter traffic. Dozens of small, outrageously expensive homes lined the opposite side of the road. A few hundred yards north was a beachside shopping area, with several popular restaurants and a bar that catered to the college crowd, which, even on a Sunday night, wouldn't have closed down until the state-mandated 2 a.m. That didn't mean the body hadn't been dumped before, too. But from Corinna's college days, as well as her years on patrol, she knew this beach saw heavy traffic until the wee hours of the morning. Before 2 a.m., it was more than likely someone would have seen a body-sized bag being tossed onto the beach. Usually, body dumps were done when no one was around, to minimize the killer's chances of being caught. Though Corinna couldn't absolutely rule out the possibility that the girl had been left earlier, logic suggested that she'd been dumped between 3 and 5 in the morning. Commuters hit the road early, and by 5:30, traffic steadily passed only 100 feet away. Sunrise had hit about 30 minutes ago.
"Do you know when she died?"
she asked Chen. He glanced up at Corinna from his position next to the body.
"Lividity isn't fixed, and it's obvious she's been moved. Her body temperature is 86.3 degrees, but I'm not sure how being wrapped in the garbage bags would affect the loss of heat."
He glanced at Jim.
"I'll do some research on that," Jim said. "I'm thinking it would slow it down, but not by much."
Chen nodded.
"That would mean she died 4 to 12 hours ago, but I'd put it closer to 4 to 8 hours, because rigor mortis hasn't completely set in. There is still some movement in her larger muscles."
Corinna made notes. 10 p.m. to 2 a.m., Sunday night. He killed the girl somewhere else. In a car? The woods? Someone's house? A secluded stretch of beach? She dismissed the last idea. There were no secluded areas on this part of the coastline, and the police routinely patrolled the area because of the nearby college. Someone kills her, puts her in their vehicle, and transports her here, to a public beach where her body would most certainly be found sooner rather than later.
"Arrogant," she muttered.
"Excuse me?" Jim asked.
"The killer, arrogant, dumped her body where we'd quickly find it. Convinced he won't be caught. Thinks he's smart."
"Dusting off your psych degree, Corinna?" Jim teased.
She rolled her eyes and smiled. Jim knew she'd taken all of one psychology class and had never graduated from college. She walked over to the uniformed officers and instructed them to canvass the area.
"Start with the houses across the street. See if someone noticed anything unusual after 10 last night, up until 5 this morning. A suspicious car, strange noise, people on the beach. Then hit the shops up the street when they open, focusing on those open past 8 p.m. Clubs and bars in particular."
As she walked back to Jim and Chen, she heard a car turn into the gravel parking lot. Her partner, Will Hooper, jumped out and strode across the sand toward them. Jim shook his head.
"Asshole," he muttered.
"Give it a rest, Jim," she said.
"Sorry, Kincaid." Will approached with a guilty grin. "I didn't hear my beeper go off."
"What's her name?"
"Come on, you woke me at 5:30 this morning. Just because you rise before the sun doesn't mean the rest of us like to suffer."
40 and divorced. Hooper enjoyed playing the field. He was also a good cop, a veteran, and Corinna trusted him with her life. He'd taught her how to play hardball in a male-dominated profession, and never once hit on her. Next to her brothers, he was her best friend.
"And? You live 10 minutes from here. Did your precious car throw a gasket?
Okay. Her name is Monica, and she lives up in Carlsbad, so it took me time to get back down here.
Corinna filled her partner in on what they'd learned. She looked back at the dead girl and noticed something unusual around her mouth.
Dr. Chen, what's that?
She knelt beside Jim and gestured toward a thin, pale yellow substance around the edges of the gag.
Lipstick? Will said. Not that you would know about that.
He tugged on her braid. Corinna ignored him. In the increasing sunlight, the gag, a black bandana, almost shimmered.
I couldn't say, Chen frowned.
Jim took out a swab from his kit and wiped the area around Jane Doe's gag. But nothing appeared to come off. He popped the swab into a sterile tube and closed it. Leaning close to the dead girl's face, he breathed deeply. Frowned. Taking prongs, he attempted to remove the gag. It was then that Corinna noticed the bandana wasn't tied. The end was wrinkled, as if it had at one point been tied in a knot. But now, it flapped free. The gag would not budge.
Glue.
Glue?
Corinna and Will repeated simultaneously.
He suffocated her, then glued the gag onto her mouth?
Corinna asked. Jim shook his head.
I don't think so. I think he glued her mouth shut, then suffocated her.
He had first killed 12 years ago. That victim hadn't been human, wasn't even a mammal. But he remembered the day with vivid nostalgia, as the day he gained a mature self-awareness and an inkling of the darkness inside. He'd been sitting on the front steps of his house, waiting for his mother's friend to leave, so he could go inside and watch cartoons. He hated sitting here by himself, doing nothing. His mom wouldn't let him leave the yard, but she wouldn't let him inside when one of her special friends visited, even when it was really cold or hot. He heard shouts down the street.
Get back here, you motherfucker!
An older boy, a bully, Tommy Jefferson, screamed at Jason Porter, a little black kid who lived on the corner, in the only two-story house on the block. Jason looked scared and was running fast, but Tommy and another kid caught up to him and tackled him right there on the sidewalk. His head hit with a dull whack on the cement and left a smear of blood. Red dripped down Jason's face as one of the boys pulled him up and shook him back and forth so his head flopped. The big kids shouted bad words at Jason and pushed him down again, but Jason managed to jump up and run quickly back up the street. The bullies were surprised and raced after him, but Jason got inside his house before they caught up. He watched the bullies throw rocks at the door until Jason's mother came out, a steak knife in hand, Jason at her side. She used some of the same bad words they'd used on her son.
Tommy, you touch my son one more time, and I'll cut off every one of your fingers. Don't you forget it.
The kids ran off, laughing. Jason's mother slammed the door shut, and the neighborhood became quiet. He was alone on the porch again. He wondered if his mother would protect him from bullies, like Jason's mom. He doubted it. A butterfly fluttered into the yard. It flew from one dying flower to another, searching for something it couldn't find, its black and orange wings pumping up and down. When it finally landed on a wilted petunia near him, he leaned forward and captured the creature in his fist. It trembled against his closed hand, the insect's little body moving frantically. The screen door slammed behind him, and he jumped.
You can go back in now, kid, the man said as he walked down the stairs.
When my daddy comes home, he's going to kill you.
The man laughed as he got into his truck and drove away. He pouted and thought about what Jason's mom said. Maybe next time that man came over, he could cut off all his fingers. Something caught his eye on the sidewalk where Jason had fallen. Curious, he crossed the dry lawn and squatted. On the rough surface of the cement, a layer of skin and some blood dried in the summer sun. He pictured Jason's bleeding face and the large scrape on the side of his head. Cool. Something moved in his hand.
He looked at his closed fist, then opened it just a bit. A bug curled in his sweaty palm. He picked it up by a wing, and it tried to fly away. Grabbing both the butterfly's wings, one in each hand, he watched the legs and antennae frantically reaching out, trying to get away. He was fascinated by the struggle. So much movement, but it wasn't getting anywhere. Slowly, he pulled the wings from the body of the bug. One came off clean, but the other tore. The dying bug fell to the sidewalk, its body jumping, squirming. He stared, fascinated, and detached at the same time, until what remained of the butterfly stopped moving. It took several minutes. Peering closely, he realized it wasn't dead. He pushed it with his finger. It jumped once, twice, then stopped. He brought the pieces of the butterfly into the kitchen to find an old jar to keep them in. The bug was not much more than dust 12 years later. But the old mayonnaise jar still rested on his nightstand. It had taken him nearly 2 hours to remove all traces of the slut from his bedroom. He wrinkled his nose in disgust. He hadn't realized she'd be so messy. She'd shit in his bed, and the smell was god-awful. Why'd she have to go do that? He'd taken her to the toilet several times a day. He'd bought the sheets and blanket especially for the weekend, so he stuffed them into a 33-gallon trash bag. Heavy duty. What a joke. The slut had torn the first bag when she tried to get out. He'd needed to use 3 just to make sure she couldn't break them. Every detail had been carefully planned. He washed her body, getting rid of any evidence of himself, though he'd taken great care all weekend. He wrapped her in the plastic bags so he could fully immerse himself in her death. At the last minute, putting a blanket on top of her body. Then he laid on her, holding her tight. She bucked beneath him, her body fighting for air, to escape. For a long minute, he lost himself in an odd state of hot ecstasy and cold fear. It really didn't take that long for her to die. In fact, it was rather anticlimactic. After 2 days of taking her to the brink of death and back, trying to figure out what made her scream and what didn't, her death was boring. She died too quickly, and he was left unsatisfied. It made him angry. Next time, he needed to think of something else. Maybe an air hole in the bag, something he controlled. Or maybe he'd do it like the movie, except he'd wrap her in some sort of plastic wrap. Most of her, anyway. He'd think more about that. It would certainly keep her clean. And if she shit, it wouldn't get all over everything. He'd watched all those forensic shows on television, and he was paranoid about the cops finding him with all their tricks. Otherwise, he would have used his hands. He wanted to. Just like the film. Squeeze. Release. Squeeze. Release. Give her just enough air. Then cut it off. Make it last. Much more satisfying. At least it looked more satisfying. He didn't try it with the slut. He had wanted to, but it was safer his way. Keep a barrier between them. Minimize contact. The plastic wrap idea might work. He sprayed disinfectant around his room, scrubbed spots he could barely see, flipped his mattress, put her clothes in the garbage bag along with the sheets. Safe. What would happen if he'd left his DNA on the body? The police had no reason to take samples of his blood or hair. Didn't they need evidence? Something to connect him? At least that's what he'd picked up from television. If they had his DNA, it wouldn't do them any good, unless they had other evidence against him. Then they'd need a warrant and all that stuff. He'd never been arrested, so it's not like a computer would flash his name and address. At first, reality had been so much better than his imagination. But then, it didn't feel right. He must have done something wrong. When she'd died, he didn't feel the rush of power he was so certain he'd feel. What could he have done different? With that thought in mind, he drove 30 miles and looked for a neighborhood that had Monday trash pickup. A quiet neighborhood,
where no one was out. He found a perfect one, where the trash cans were in the alley. He threw the sheets and clothes and everything the slut might have touched into a half-full garbage bin. He had 30 minutes to get to class, and the garbage truck had just rounded the corner. Perfect timing.
Chapter 2
Glue! Will shook his head. I can't believe the bastard glued her mouth shut, then did those things to her.
They'd parked near each other in the garage, adjacent to the police station, and walked inside together. It was close to 8, nearing shift change, and uniforms were coming in from patrol.
Corinna waved to a few of her friends. Though, when she'd made detective last year, after 10 years as a beat cop, some of the guys had given her the cold shoulder.
Hell, not just the guys. The other women on the force were twice as bad.
It was like starting from square one, all over again.
He tortured her, Corinna said to Will. Gluing her mouth shut, raping her, suffocating her. This guy is sick.
Will looked both ill and angry.
We need to run a search for similar crimes.
They sat down to start plugging information into the computer. Corinna's phone rang.
Kincaid,
she answered.
Dean Robertson here.
Dean was now in charge of missing persons, though when she first joined the force 11 years ago, he'd been Corinna's training officer.
What's up?
Heard you found a Jane Doe this morning. She matches the description of a possible missing person.
Possible?
I had a strange visit Saturday.
Saturday? I thought the chief told you no more weekends.
He grunted.
You going to turn me in for working unclocked hours?
Me? You said Friday, right?
Dean had been known to work off the clock almost as many hours as his regular shift. Never married. He'd told Corinna once over beers that he couldn't not work. There are missing kids out there, Corinna. Their parents deserve to know whether they're dead or alive.
Yeah, they did.
Dean continued.
This guy comes in, clean cut, late 30s, maybe 40, wanted to report a missing person, female, 18. Matches the description of your Jane Doe. The desk sergeant took the information at first, then bumped it over to me when the guy got all huffy that we weren't doing something right away.
How long had she been missing?
Less than 24.
His daughter?
Nope.
No.
She wrinkled her nose.
What's his story?
He claims they were friends. That he suspected someone was following her and had told her to watch herself. She hadn't taken him seriously.
Why'd he think she was missing?
She didn't go online Saturday.
Online? As in computer?
Yep. That's how they met. Through a computer class at UCSD.
Concern laced Dean's voice.
Something's weird about this. And since the girl's basic description matches your Jane Doe, I thought you might want to follow up with her family.
And the guy?
Stephen Thomas. I'll send up a folder with all the information.
What's the girl's name?
Angela Vance. Goes by Angie.
Thanks, Dean. I'll let you know what happens.
Corinna had just finished telling Will about the call when a secretary dropped Dean's folder on her desk. She opened the folder. No photo. Angela, Angie, Vance, 18, blonde hair, brown eyes, approximately 5 feet 5 inches tall, and 115 pounds. Her Jane Doe was 5 feet 4 and a half and 120. Angie was a freshman at UC San Diego, with an undeclared major. She lived with her mother and grandmother downtown.
What's wrong?
Will watched her closely.
What's this Thomas guy's interest in a girl half his age? He told Dean they were friends from school, but...
She logged onto the DMV database and pulled down Angie Vance's driver's license photo. She stared at the bright smile and short brown hair. Her Vic had longer, blonder hair, but the photograph had been taken more than 2 years ago. Corinna's chest tightened. Women change their hair color all the time. The face matched their victim. She showed Will, and he concurred. Angie Vance could be their Vic.
I'll run Thomas, Will said.
Let's do it from the road,
Corinna said, jumping up and throwing her lightweight blazer over her black T-shirt.
I want to check out Angie Vance's house and see if we can get a recent picture of her before we talk to her mother.
Angie lived in a small post-war bungalow in North Park, an old neighborhood in central San Diego. It was noon on Monday, and Corinna suspected no one would be home. She was wrong. Angie's elderly grandmother directed them to Angie's mother, Debbie, who was working as a waitress at Bud's Diner near the highway. Grandma also supplied a recent photograph. During the short drive to the diner, Corinna stared at the photo. It was of mother and daughter, both wearing burgundy sweaters that offset their fair skin. Debbie Vance had brown hair, and Angie, extensive blonde highlights. The older woman had been pretty in her day, but in the picture she looked a little gray and worn, though happy. Her daughter was beautiful, with long shiny hair, curled for the photograph, eyes tastefully made up, and a warm and inviting smile. Now, Angie was dead. Jane Doe and this pretty girl were one and the same. Corinna closed her eyes, putting herself in Debbie Vance's shoes. Knowing exactly how the woman would feel when told someone she loved was dead. While Corinna was pleased to have a quick identification of the victim, she dreaded having to break a mother's heart. The call on the radio confirmed it. The coroner ran Jane Doe's fingerprints in the system. Nothing in the criminal database, but the Department of Motor Vehicles popped up with her driver's license. Angela Vance. Bud's Diner looked like a greasy spoon on the outside, but once they stepped through the doors, the rich aroma of a real country breakfast, sweet syrup, salty potatoes, sizzling bacon, reminded Corinna that she hadn't eaten.
"Take any table,"
a waitress said as she poured coffee with one hand and put down a plate of butter-drenched waffles.
"Is Mrs. Vance available?"
The waitress looked up with a frown, but didn't need to say anything.
"I'm Debbie Vance."
Corinna might not have recognized the short, chubby woman of about 40, her cherubic face bright from the heat of the kitchen. But the warm smile was the same as the photograph. Debbie Vance came around from behind the counter.
"And you are?"
"Detectives William Hooper and Corinna Kincaid, San Diego Police Department," Will said. "Is there a private area where we can talk?"
Debbie Vance slowly nodded, her expression confused, her eyes asking questions she didn't voice. Knowing something was wrong, but not wanting to ask for fear the question would bring a tragic answer. Corinna remembered the feeling.
"This way,"
Mrs. Vance said tightly. She led them through the kitchen to a small crowded office that had no door. She looked around for three chairs, but there was only one. No one sat. Corinna asked,
"Mrs. Vance, when was the last time you saw your daughter?"
Her lip quivered.
"Is something wrong with Angie?"
Corinna didn't say anything, and Mrs. Vance continued in a rush, looking from Corinna to Will.
"Friday morning. I was leaving for work when she got up to go to classes. She goes to UCSD, you know, on full scholarship. She's very smart, straight A's all through high school." She took a deep breath. "She goes out with friends on the weekends, and I work early and go to bed early, so I don't really keep tabs on her anymore. She's 18. She's a good girl, never got into drugs. I didn't think I needed to watch. Oh, God."
Her voice cracked.
"I heard her come in late Friday night, after 1. But when I checked on her Saturday before I left for work, she was already gone."
Mrs. Vance searched their expression.
"What's wrong? What's happened?"
Mothers always know. Corinna took her hand as Mrs. Vance sat heavily into the only chair. Will said in a quiet voice,
"A body was found on the beach this morning that matches Angie's description."
Mrs. Vance stared at them, shaking her head. She'd asked, but she didn't want to hear. Corinna didn't blame her. No one wanted to hear when someone they loved and nurtured was dead.
"No, I would know. It's not Angie. You don't know it's her, right?"
Corinna didn't tell her the DMV prints matched. It seemed too cold. Instead, she said,
When you feel up to it, we'd like you to come down to confirm her identity.
Right now. Right now. It's not her.
She closed her eyes, took a deep breath, and said,
What happened to the girl you found?
There was never an easy way to tell a parent their child was dead.
She was murdered, Mrs. Vance,
Corinna said softly.
Someone killed her? On purpose? Who?
We're doing everything we can to find out, Will said. The waitress with the waffles, her tag said Denise, pushed herself into the small room, and Mrs. Vance turned to her, sobbing.
They think my Angie is dead.
The two women embraced, and Corinna steeled her emotions, willing herself not to remember the agony and pain of losing a loved one to violence. When the two women separated, she asked,
Mrs. Vance, does Angie have a close friend we can speak with? Maybe a boyfriend? Someone who might know where she went Friday night? That's what happened,
Mrs. Vance said, with a certainty that wasn't as evident in her shaking hands as it was in her voice.
She was with Abby and Jody. They have an apartment near campus. She's always staying there.
She scrawled the names and an address and phone number on the back of a guest ticket.
Maybe Kayla, but they're not as close as Angie and Abby. What about her father?
Mrs. Vance shook her head.
Carl left years ago, when Angie was not much more than a baby. We don't keep in touch anymore. He remarried and moved out of state, doesn't even remember to send Angie birthday cards.
Her words ended in a sob, which she swallowed back, putting a stoic expression on her face, holding it together.
She'll be back today, after class.
Denial.
Do you know her boyfriends? Angie wasn't steady with anyone.
She never talked about boyfriends with you?
Yes, but not in detail. She doesn't have a regular fellow. She's too young for that. And that's fine with me. I always tell her.
She stopped suddenly, looking lost.
Mrs. Vance?
She shook her head, gave them a half-smile.
I was just thinking, everything's going to be okay. You're wrong. The poor girl, she's not Angie.
Mrs. Vance, do you know Steve Thomas?
The name sounds familiar, she said. I think she talked about him around Christmas, or Thanksgiving. I think they went on a couple dates, but it wasn't serious. Why?
Will evaded the question by asking about any other casual boyfriends. Mrs. Vance couldn't think of any boys Angie had been seeing recently. Corinna didn't have any more questions. Not right now. She knew she'd have to face Mrs. Vance again. At the funeral. Possibly at the house, collecting evidence. Asking more questions. She certainly wasn't looking forward to any of it. She would much rather interview suspects and witnesses than talk to the victim's family. Will handed Debbie Vance a card with the coroner's name and address.
If you can come by sometime today to identify the body, we would appreciate it. Just call this number and tell them you're coming. They'll have everything ready. You don't even need to be in the same room. They'll show you on a screen.
Her lip quivered, but she nodded.
I'm sure it's a misunderstanding.
When Will and Corinna were outside, Corinna took several deep breaths before getting into their car.
Kara, are you okay?
Just give me a second.
It was the quiet anguish that got to her. The pain in the eyes. The firm denial, even with the internal knowledge that the police wouldn't come ask her to view a body if they weren't nearly 100% positive of the identity already. Because there was always hope. She squeezed her eyes closed and tilted her head to the sun. 1, 2, 3. Better. She tamped down on her own pain and frustration and turned to Will.
I want to talk to Steve Thomas.
Steve Thomas's oceanfront apartment was within biking distance to the university, as evidenced by the wide and well-used bike paths along the highway. There were 8 units. 4 on top, 4 on bottom. A dozen similar apartment buildings took up this stretch of the highway, half a block from the beach.
When she'd been in college, one of her boyfriends had had a place out here, about a mile away, similar to Thomas's apartment. Ocean access justified the outrageous rent. On the south side of the building, college-aged men and women walked on the path connecting the street to the beach. It was a Monday in February. But if you didn't have classes, the San Diego beaches were incomparable virtually year-round. Surfers would be out en masse. The temperature promised to be 82 today, and while the water was cold, wetsuits made it tolerable. Invigorating. Sometimes Corinna missed the carefree life she'd enjoyed in college, when she could drop everything and pick up her surfboard. When was the last time she'd hit the waves? 5, 6 years ago? She and her brother Connor had gone out before a big storm, nearly wiped out. Even though they were adults, her dad had been furious. They'd had a blast, though. It had been worth Dad's stern lecture. She was so out of practice now that she didn't dare go out under the same conditions. Even today's tame waves would be a challenge. Their radio beeped. "Hooper here," Will answered. "Sergeant Fields, I have something on the Thomas guy." "Shoot." "He's clean. Except for a restraining order." Corinna raised an eyebrow at Will. "Anything else?" "Oh, yeah," Fields responded. "Angela Vance, the girl he reported missing, put it on him 3 weeks ago."
Chapter 3. Corinna and Will approached Thomas's apartment with caution, but he wasn't home. They called in a patrol to check the area every hour and notify them when he returned. She said to Will, as they drove to the university to locate Angie's friends, "We'll play nice until we can build a case."
"Think he's the one?" Will asked.
"Don't know, but she was obviously scared of him. And what's a 39-year-old man doing following 18-year-old girls?"
"Don't look at me," Will exclaimed. "I like my women past the chewing gum stage."
Corinna smiled.
"I wasn't making a moral judgment on your sex life, Hooper. It's just creepy, you know?"
A quick run in the system showed that Thomas had no known occupation, though he received a pension from the U.S. Army. The desk sergeant was trying to dig a little deeper into the guy's military records to see if there was anything else worth knowing. And just because he didn't have a job on record didn't mean he wasn't working somewhere. The college administration gave them only a few minutes of frustration before handing over Abby Ivers's schedule and a copy of her photo ID. Will asked about Steve Thomas, confirmed that he was also a student, and sweet-talked the secretary into peeking at his schedule. Corinna didn't like to play loose with the rules. Evidence could later be thrown out in court if they screwed up in the field. But if Thomas was on campus, they could track him down. It would be nearly noon when Abby's English lit class would end, so Will and Corinna grabbed hot dogs at the student union and munched while watching the doors of the building.
"So Angie Vance was last seen Friday morning?" Will said.
"But her mother heard her come in late Friday night."
"Though she didn't actually see her."
"Steve Thomas comes by the station to file a missing persons report on Saturday morning. Why would he do that?"
"To throw suspicion off himself?"
"That's stupid."
"Who said killers were smart?"
Corinna frowned.
"The murder was sadistic."
"Maybe he raped her and she suffocated and he panicked, dumped her body."
"Hmm."
It was a thought. But why the elaborate setup? The glue? The garbage bags? The public beach?
"What do you think about calling Dylan for an informal opinion?"
"Couldn't hurt, if your brother has the time."
"He always makes time for me. What's family for if we can't bug each other at all hours of the day and night?"
She took another bite out of her hot dog, swallowed, and said,
"I'd like to hear what Dr. Chen says. Friday night to Monday morning? That's a long time. If we believe that she was home on Friday night, that's a full 48 hours before she died. Where did he keep her in the meantime?"
"If it's Steve Thomas, not in his apartment. The walls in complexes like that are paper thin," Will said.
"Maybe he glued her mouth shut to keep her from screaming."
The case was giving her the creeps. She much preferred a clear-cut domestic violence or gang shooting. Angie's murder didn't fit into anything she'd seen before. So she hoped Dylan had some insight. Her brother was a forensic psychiatrist, and this case
would give his psychiatry degree a workout. She'd call him as soon as they were done here. Corinna watched students start pouring from the building. She hadn't particularly liked college. She was too active, too antsy. And she ended up dropping out, with only a year to go, and joining the police academy. But there were other reasons for that decision.
Over there. Will hit Corinna on the arm, tossing the last third of his hot dog in the trash.
Corinna followed suit.
That looks like Abby.
Abby Ivers was a cute, perky blonde in a tight t-shirt and low-waist jeans. Deep dimples sliced her cheeks, and her eye makeup was heavily applied.
Abby?
She introduced herself and Will and flashed her badge.
Do you have a minute?
Corinna motioned for her to follow them back to the bench where they'd been sitting.
Sure,
she said, hugging her books to her chest and frowning.
I guess.
When they were seated, Corinna asked,
When was the last time you saw Angie Vance?
Abby's eyes grew wide.
Oh, God, something happened,
she said, all in one breath.
Why do you say that? Because she hasn't returned any of my emails, and her IM is offline, and she didn't journal all weekend. I TM'd her on Saturday night, and it bounced back because her cell wasn't on.
Abby sounded just like Corinna's sister, Lucy. TM'd? Will asked.
Text messaged,
Corinna translated.
Right, so what happened? Did she get in an accident or something? Is she in the hospital? She's okay, right? I'm sorry, but she's dead,
Corinna said gently. Abby's tanned face noticeably paled.
Dead?
Her chin quivered.
What happened?
Corinna gave her the bare minimum story.
When was the last time you saw her? Friday night? Where? The sand shack. On Camino del Oro, off the beach.
Abby's eyes teared, and Corinna glanced at Will. He asked in his soothing voice,
What time did you see her?
She left at 12:30, I think. She works there, you know, but got off at 10. Then we just hung out. Jody and I walked her to her car, but we went back because there was this cute guy. Did her mom say she didn't get home? Did she get carjacked?
Like many survivors, she was looking for answers. Unfortunately, they didn't have any.
We're trying to establish when and where Angie was seen. Was anyone paying unusual attention to her? Giving her a hard time? Maybe she had a boyfriend she'd broken up with recently.
Abby blushed and looked down.
Angie had a lot of boyfriends. I mean, they all loved her, but she was particular. How so?
Abby shrugged.
Abby, if you have anything to tell us, now would be the time. There's nothing. Just, she broke up with a lot of guys because they weren't the one.
The one?
Like, someone you want to spend the rest of your life with?
She diverted her eyes and sniffed.
Angie was such a romantic.
Corinna sensed that Abby wasn't telling them something. But before she could push, Will said, What about Steve Thomas?
What about Steve?
Was she one of Angie's ex-boyfriends? She nodded.
They dated back in November, I think. Maybe December, too.
But he wasn't the one,
Will said, using Abby's own phrase.
No, they weren't even exclusive. Abby.
Corinna remained silent until the girl looked at her.
Is there something else you think might be important? Something about Angie that might help us find out what happened to her? No, nothing,
she said, too fast. Before they could push her, a male voice called from across the courtyard.
Abby!
Corinna and Will turned simultaneously and watched a lean, athletically built man with broad shoulders run toward Abby. He was older than the average college student and barely gave them a glance before saying,
Abby, have you seen Angie at all this weekend?
Angie's dead!
Abby grabbed his arm and held on tightly, her voice quivering.
Steve, these are the police. They're talking to Angie's friends.
Steve?
Steve Thomas?
Corinna watched the man's face closely. He matched the description Dean Robertson had given her over the phone. Dark blonde hair, blue eyes, late 30s. His face tightened, and he shook his head.
No, damn it.
He looked up to the sky and breathed deeply.
I knew she was playing with fire. I just... Oh, Angie.
He closed his eyes. He pulled Abby into a hug, and she clung onto him. Corinna cleared her throat, and Steve let Abby go, but held her to his side. He glared at Will and Corinna.
I went to the police on Saturday. I knew no one believed me.
Is it true? Is Angie really dead?
His tone was full of anger and accusation. Corinna wondered where it was coming from. One minute he sounded like he was concerned, talking to Abby. The next ticked off. Anyone who could flip a switch that fast had anger close to the surface. They showed their IDs.
Steve Thomas? Will asked. Did you try to file a missing persons report on Saturday?
Not that anyone would listen to me. I knew something was wrong, but because she hadn't been missing long enough, the cop said he couldn't do anything.
He let out a deep breath.
I'm sorry.
What happened?
Are you sure it's Angie?
Do you have a few minutes to talk? Will asked, without answering Thomas's questions.
He looked like he was going to refuse, then gave a curt nod. Corinna said, Let's go to the student union, Mr. Thomas. Unless you would prefer to talk downtown.
Fine,
Thomas said through clenched teeth. After taking down Abby's contact information, they let her go. Corinna planned to talk to her again. Abby knew something. Now, however, they were faced with a suspect. The overwhelming majority of the time, when a woman was killed, it was by her husband, boyfriend, or an ex. Will led them to a relatively quiet table on the far side of the student union, though with the lunch crowd coming in, it was rapidly filling up.
What happened to Angie?
Was Thomas's first question.
We're waiting for a positive identification of her body, but...
So it might not be her!
He started to rise, but Will motioned for him to sit.
We're certain it's her, said Will. The rest is just a formality.
Thomas sank back into his chair, his military straight posture caving. Was his hope that she was alive an act? He sounded genuine, but killers were liars. They could con anyone, often keeping their crimes from their loved ones. Lying to the police was second nature to criminals.
Where were you Friday night?
He tensed, sitting up straight. Grief, if that's what it was, turned to hot anger.
I don't fucking believe this! I'm the one who told you guys something was wrong!
Thomas was an explosive pendulum of emotions. Almost as soon as he finished his outburst, he took another deep breath and apologized.
I'm sorry. I thought I was doing the right thing going to the police, but now you're here talking to me rather than looking for whoever killed Angie.
Mr. Thomas, Corinna said, I can assure you that regardless of your actions on Saturday, we would have been talking to you eventually. You're Angie's ex-boyfriend, and she filed a restraining order against you.
That was...
Will interrupted.
Where were you Friday night?
When? Thomas asked through gritted teeth.
Let's start at dinner and work from there.
I had dinner with a friend at a Mexican restaurant downtown.
Does your friend have a name?
Yes.
And?
It doesn't have anything to do with Angie's disappearance.
It would establish an alibi.
I can't believe this,
he repeated.
I didn't have anything to do with what happened to Angie.
Did you see Angie Friday night?
I saw her at the sand shack when she got off work, around 10. I offered to take her home. She declined. I left.
You offered to take her home when she has a restraining order against you?
Corinna looked at her notes.
According to the order, you are not allowed within 100 yards of Angie, unless you're in class.
You don't understand.
Enlighten us.
Thomas didn't say anything for nearly a minute. Trying to think up a lie? Concoct an alibi? Corinna sensed that something was off, but she couldn't put her finger on it.
Angie and I broke up over 2 months ago.
We parted friends. Ask anyone. Ask Abby.
But Angie, she started getting into the party scene. She started seeing this asshole, Doug Masterson. I swear, Angie never took drugs until Doug gave her some coke. I confronted Angie, warned her. We got into an argument, and, well, I said some things I shouldn't have. Her friend Kayla convinced her to get the restraining order.
Did you threaten her?
No.
Then why was she scared of you?
Steve clenched his fists.
She wasn't scared of me. She was scared of what I said.
She just took it out on me.
What did you say that scared her?
He paused, looked at his hands, which were clasped tightly in front of him.
It sounds bad, but I wanted her to see that her actions have consequences.
What did you say?
Corinna repeated. His face reddened as he stared at Corinna. Anger? Guilt? Fear? His voice was low.
I told her if she didn't watch herself, she'd end up dead.
Chapter 4. The sand shack was across the highway from the beach. A cross between a Hawaiian luau and surfer haven, the outside eating area was larger than the indoor, and there were racks for surfboards, towels, and backpacks. Several people were eating monstrous-sized hamburgers, wearing nothing but bathing suits and flip-flops. A half-dozen web hookups along one wall allowed patrons to surf the internet after surfing the waves. When Corinna was in college, the sand shack had been called Big John's and was one of the last 50s-style soda shops, less casual, but still a hangout for students. She'd have loved a place like the shack, though she missed the old-fashioned soda fountain and jukebox that only played 50s and 60s bubblegum rock. She and Will approached one of the waitstaff, who wore a uniform of jeans and red t-shirt, with the sand shack in white across the back.
We need to speak to the owner or manager.
Sure.
He scurried off. Moments later, a man approached.
I'm the manager. Kyle Burns, can I help you?
Burns was in his mid to late 20s, with short sandy brown hair, inquisitive blue eyes, and the body of a weightlifter. They identified themselves, and Will said,
Do you have an office or somewhere private we can talk?
He frowned, opened his mouth, then closed it, and led the way to the back of the restaurant. A small alcove off the large, spotless stainless steel kitchen served as an office. Burns glanced at his watch, and Corinna asked,
Are we keeping you?
No, it's okay. I have a class at 3. I just came in for the lunchtime rush because my assistant manager didn't show up.
He pulled a sliding pocket door from the jamb and closed them into the office, then sat on the corner of the organized desk. It was a tight fit for the three of them, and Will leaned in a deceptively casual stance against the narrow wall.
What can I help you with? Burns asked. When was the last time you saw Angela Vance?
Will asked. Burns looked from Will to Corinna and back to Will.
She's my assistant who didn't show up. Did something happen? Is she okay?
Did you see her this weekend? Burns's jaw tightened, as if he didn't like that Will hadn't answered his questions.
She worked Friday night and I haven't seen her since.
Do you have her schedule handy? The manager reached over to a swinging file system on the corner of the desk and pulled a folder from near the back.
Here.
Will looked through it, while Corinna asked,
Do you know if Angie was dating someone? Who her close friends were? If anyone has been giving her problems here at work?
She's been seeing this guy, Doug Masterson. I told her to watch out for him after I had to kick him out for trying to sell drugs on the premises. I told her he wasn't welcome, and if I found out she let him come in when I was off, I'd fire her. I didn't want to, but this is a clean place. I want to keep it that way.
He paused and asked in a voice tinged with worry.
What happened? You wouldn't be here unless something happened to Angie.
Corinna answered.
Angie's body was found on the beach early this morning.
Her body? You mean she's dead?
Burns seemed genuinely surprised,
and hurt by the news. But, as Corinna thought while interviewing Steve Thomas, killers were skilled in deception.
"Angie worked Friday night," Will said. "Were you here?"
He nodded.
"I close on the weekends. It's busy, and I don't like the girls handling the cash at night. I know that sounds sexist, and I've had more than one girl give me a hard time about it, but I'd rather do the bank drops, you know what I mean?"
"The streets are dangerous," Will agreed, glancing down at the schedule. "It says Angie worked from 4 to 10.
"Yeah, but she was hanging out with some friends until much later."
"Until when?"
"I'm not sure. But at least midnight. That's when her ex-boyfriend came in and I had to escort him out."
He shook his head.
"Angie really knows how to pick them. Damn it. I should have talked to her. Done something to... Hell, I don't know."
A knock on the door interrupted Corinna's next question. Burns leaned over and slid open the door.
"What's up?"
A tall, clean-cut teen, probably a college student, like most of the employees at the shack, looked at Corinna and Will, curiously.
Kyle? The Pepsi guy's here. He wants you to sign off on the new order."
"Tell him I'll be out in 5 minutes. Go ahead and put the stock away. I trust you'll make sure everything's there."
The kid nodded, hesitating, as if he were going to ask something, then slid the door closed.
"Anything else?" Burns asked.
"You said you escorted Angie's ex-boyfriend out. Do you know his name?"
"Steve Thomas. A couple weeks ago he came in when Angie was on duty, and they got into a huge fight, both of them yelling. The next day, Angie tells me she filed a restraining order against him."
"Do you remember what the argument was about?"
"I'm not sure, but the rumors going around were that Steve still had the hots for Angie, and lectured her about Masterson. Angie doesn't like being told what to do, and who to date. But Steve was right on the money about that low-life Masterson."
He sighed, and suddenly looked older than what Corinna had pegged as 25.
"I liked Angie, but the men she dated were all too old for her. Steve has to be nearly 40. Masterson is over 30. There were at least 4 or 5 other guys Angie brought in since she started working here last summer. All of them over 30.
He shook his head, frowning.
"On Friday," Corinna asked, "what time did Angie leave?"
"I'm not sure. Probably shortly after I escorted Steve out, which was just after midnight. He wasn't happy. But he didn't give me a bad time."
"What did he say?"
Burns paused, thinking.
"I think he said, 'Tell Angie to be careful.'"
Outside, Corinna and Will called into dispatch to update the patrol watching Steve's apartment. Corinna turned to Will.
"Steve Thomas flat out lied to us. He said 10. Burns says midnight.
And just put himself at the top of the suspect list."
Maybe he was being paranoid, but he went home during lunch to double-check that there was nothing of Angie's left in his room. There was a smell, something that hadn't been there before. He went to the bathroom, pulled a can of Lysol disinfectant from under the sink, and sprayed it in the bathroom, bedroom, and then everywhere else, just in case. He'd made his bed with fresh linens before he left. Now he sat down and looked around. Everything was neat, organized, as it should be. He reached into his nightstand drawer and pulled out a metal box, about the size of a shoebox, and ran his fingers over the combination lock until it sprang open. Inside were pictures, a couple small jars, a knife, a few other items that held special importance for him, and a faded birthday card from his father, still in the envelope, postmarked Corcoran Prison. He didn't look at the card, which was underneath everything else. Instead, he picked up the newest addition to the box, Angie's navel ring. The first time he'd seen the navel ring, he'd been at the sand shack, and she'd walked in, off duty, wearing a bikini top and short shorts. He stared. He couldn't help it. It was like a light was shining on her, a bright light,
and everything became clear. He knew Angie. She and his online fantasy were one and the same. He didn't need to confirm it, but he did, right there. He couldn't wait until he went home. He logged onto a computer, the shack had several hookups, and went to myjournal.com. Click, click, click. There. The navel ring. One of the A for Anonymous pictures. Right there next to the journal entry where she described what it was like to give a guy a blowjob. Half the college girls had navel rings, but Angie's was unique. A gold hoop with three hanging charms. A seashell, a leaf, and a rose. The same as the picture. But if that wasn't enough to convince him that he knew his fantasy girl, she also sported the same rose tattoo on her breast, revealed by her bikini. Angie was the slut. He went home, read Angie's online diary again. His fantasies, which had been only that, untouchable, were now in clear focus. She was meant to be his. It was as if some god had thrown all the pieces to the puzzle in his lap, and he'd finally put it together. Angie was a whore. A slut. Cut from the same cloth as the whore who'd lied about his father. On the surface, Angie was nice, sweet, polite, almost demure. But in private, she revealed her true self, talking about her sexual relations with nearly a dozen men over the last 6 months. Fucking hypocrite whore. And she walked right into his trap. It was obviously meant to be. Everything. His plan worked from setup to execution. She had walked right up to him, smiled. I came as soon as I could. He'd driven to his place. She hadn't even thought to question it. The lie he'd told her was so believable, she didn't doubt his sincerity for a minute. It wasn't until they were inside that he saw a brief look of panic. He gave her a Coke. 20 minutes later, she was unconscious. When she woke up, she was tied to his bed, her mouth glued shut. Naked. His penis grew hard from the vision of Angie, so vulnerable, shivering, and trying to scream. He shook his head, clearing the memories. He was going to be late for class. He locked up his treasures and rushed out. He'd let himself fully remember Angie and his methodical breaking of her spirit later. Tonight. When he could enjoy it. Chapter 5. Will and Corinna were 15 minutes late for Angie Vance's autopsy, and Chen had gone ahead and prepped the body.
What did we miss?
Corinna pulled on a smock and latex gloves, though she had no intention of touching the body.
The next of kin left 30 minutes ago, so you haven't missed much. I just started.
That was fast,
Corinna said to Will.
She must have come down right after we left her.
Wouldn't you?
Will asked her. Corinna hated facing death, but she would want to know with every certainty. She'd need to see the truth with her own eyes. Chen motioned for them to approach the table.
Something interesting I noticed as soon as I started the visual examination. Someone washed her body before she died.
Chen stood at Angie's feet, a laser pen in hand.
Why?
That's your job, not mine. There was soap residue under her arms and in her hair. I sent samples to the lab, but the body was cleaned, no doubt in my mind. From the moisture in her skin, I'd say she was wrapped in the bags shortly after the bath.
Why would he clean the body?
Corinna asked, almost to herself.
To get rid of evidence?
Very likely, Will said,
though Corinna's question had been more rhetorical.
Creepy, she said. And planned. He held her captive, raped her, kept her under his control for 48 hours. Then he releases her to wash her before killing? Why not kill her, then wash her body? It would be easier. She wouldn't be able to fight back.
She may have been too weak to fight, Will offered. Or drugged.
Chen said,
We've sent blood samples to the lab, and we'll collect tissue and stomach contents during the exam.
He pointed the laser pen at her ankles and then her wrists.
She was restrained with rope. You can see the rope burns on her limbs. I was able to find a couple fibers embedded in her skin that hadn't been washed away. Probably nylon or a cotton fiber, not hemp.
Corinna had been avoiding Angie's face. But now that Chen had turned his attention to her mouth, she had to look. The bandana had been removed, though threads of it still clung to her lips, which were grotesque, purple and red pulp. Her neck was bruised as well, though it didn't look like hand or finger marks, which would be one sign of possible strangulation. Her open eyes showed burst blood vessels. Not all suffocation deaths showed reticular hemorrhaging, which was why many nursing home or infant murders were deemed natural causes, attributed to old age or sudden infant death syndrome. But Angie's death was not peaceful. She had fought for every breath, the evidence of her failure still in her eyes.
The glue was an industrial-strength superglue of some sort. I've never seen this before in my career. Because the skin is a porous surface, glue would be absorbed in the skin and wouldn't hold its strength for any extended period of time. Because the skin is constantly losing cells, eventually the glue would flake off. But the addition of the bandana gave the glue something to adhere to.
He directed their attention to the victim's overall appearance. She hadn't been fed or given fluid in at least 48 hours. She has obvious signs of dehydration. The signs weren't obvious to Corinna, but she took Chen's word for it.
I'm certain when we get inside I can confirm that.
But there are two things that are odd.
Odd? This could get weirder?
Chen directed the laser to her stomach.
Bruising takes several minutes to hours to form, depending on the trauma. Bruising is a constantly changing process, the color and size and depth of the injury growing, then shrinking and fading. Her stomach and upper chest appear to have the beginning signs of bruising. Very faint.
Faint? Will said.
I can't see anything.
Corinna focused on the areas Chen indicated. She'd never have noticed anything unusual until he pointed out the very slight discoloration.
What can cause that? She asked.
Any number of things. And it happened around the time of death. Bruising stops after the heart stops beating. Something heavy was placed on her, perhaps to facilitate her death or to keep her body from convulsing.
A horrific thought came to Corinna.
Could the killer have laid on top of her?
Yes, Chen said, a rare sigh coming from deep in his chest. It's cases like this that make me think about early retirement, he said quietly, looking at Angie's face.
What's the second odd thing?
He pointed the laser at her navel.
She recently had a navel ring ripped out. It had begun to heal, so I'd guess it was removed 24 to 48 hours before her death.
He turned his attention from the tear in the navel to the two detectives on the other side of the table.
Ready?
No, Corinna thought, but nodded along with Will. They silently observed Chen's meticulous internal examination, his assistant following orders expeditiously. By the end of the autopsy, they had learned and confirmed several important facts. Angela Vance had been raped multiple times. There was extensive tearing and deep tissue damage in both orifices, indicating that a sharp foreign object had penetrated. There was no biological evidence. The killer could have used a condom. If he didn't, that evidence had probably been destroyed or contaminated when he cleaned the body. Chen collected possible trace evidence, tissue samples, and additional blood samples to send to the lab. He confirmed that she hadn't eaten in at least 12 hours, because her stomach was void of food. Jim Gage joined them halfway through the autopsy and confirmed that Angie had suffocated in the bag. While the tox screen was clean, the additional tissue and blood samples would be sent to the county lab, which could test for a broader array of drugs. Jim also collected hair samples to test for cocaine to determine whether Steve Thomas's accusation that Masterson was feeding her the drug had merit. If she took cocaine more than a week earlier, it wouldn't show up in her blood, but it would show up in her hair follicles. Not that drug use would prove Masterson was responsible for her death, but they never knew what information was important or incidental until they closed the case.